My name's Nicola Bullard. I'm working with an NGO called Focus on the Global South, which is an Asian-based campaigning and research organisation. I'm working in the climate justice program at Focus. Our organisation is also a very active member of the Climate Justice Now network. We were very involved in Copenhagen last year in the Reclaim Power action. We work a lot also with the CJA.
Climate justice, to explain to the German public, the listeners, what does it mean?
I think a fundamental meaning of climate justice is that those people and communities who have contributed the least to causing the problem of climate justice should not be forced to bear the burden of the impacts or the false solutions to climate change. And by that we mean that the poor, marginalised, the coastal communities, the peasant farmers, the fishers, the urban poor, these are the communities and sectors in the south and in the north who have contributed the least to global warming, yet ironically, these are the communities who are also feeling the harshest impacts, and they shouldn't be forced to pay the price.
So what are your points of critique towards the treaties that we already have in international climate regime, which is Kyoto, basically?
Yeah. Well, you know, we started off with the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which in itself contains some very sound principles. The historical responsibility and common and differentiated responsibilities, I think, is a principle of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change that we should uphold, because when it was first agreed in the convention, it was clearly understood that there is a differentiation between responsibility and also capacities, that rich countries who have benefited from using up all of this fossil fuel should also pay the highest in terms of contributing to finding solutions and also in terms of reducing their own emissions. So that, I think that's a very important principle in the convention, but that principle has been steadily not only watered down but completely distorted. And now what we see inside the Kyoto Protocol and also in these climate negotiations over the past few years is what I call the neoliberalisation of the climate negotiations. We can see that the market thinking, neoliberal thinking, the dependence on financial markets to make good policy choices, that's the logic that's being applied to these negotiations. So, in fact, what started out as an environmental negotiation is now, in fact, become de facto a kind of trade and economic negotiation, using all of the tools of the market to solve our environmental crises.
Well, both of us were not really that kind of market believers, but could you explain what sense the market solution is not helping solving the problem, but probably like making it more difficult or serious?
Well, I think one aspect of the let's say carbon markets are the main tool that is being proposed to deal with the issue of deforestation, to deal with the question of pollution, to even promote clean technology and clean development. The market the creation, if you like, of carbon credits is the main mechanism that's being used. And how these carbon credits operate is, for example, you have, say, a coal power plant in Germany. And this coal power plant has the government gives a cap, gives an upper limit on how much emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, can come from this one single power plant. Now, it's very good if this power plant can keep their emissions just at the level of the limit that's set by the German government. That's very good. If they go over that limit, it means that they have to buy some carbon credits from somewhere else. Now, they can buy these carbon credits from somewhere else, either in Europe, which might be another factory which, for example, has done a much better job of reducing their emissions and they've got some surplus credits, so they can buy, you know, some credits from the cement factory down the road, for example. But in fact, what happens more frequently is that they buy credits by investing in what's called the Clean Development Mechanism. And the Clean Development Mechanism is a tool whereby carbon credits can be created by investing in projects which are supposedly clean. And I'll just very briefly give you an example of what an absurdity this is. If you, for example, the Asian Development Bank, which is the largest multilateral development bank across Asia, has a benchmark for what it calls clean energy. And that benchmark is a coal power plant fueled by brown coal. So you can imagine it's almost the dirtiest kind of energy production that you can think of. And anything that is slightly better than that is regarded as clean energy. So if you have this very sort of absolutely absurd baseline of what's called clean energy, then anything that is slightly better than a dirty brown coal plant can actually attract carbon credits, because the German company can invest a little bit by building a new smokestack on some coal power plant in, say, the Philippines. And because it's a little bit cleaner than the minimal bottom line, or it's a little bit cleaner than the emissions of the year before, then it can create these credits which can then be bought by the German company so that they can meet their targets that have been set by the German government. So it's this, it's not an easy thing to explain, but it's a total scam, because what it means, of course, is that there is no reduction in emissions. What it means is that the German power plant is not reducing its emissions, and what they're doing is actually investing in energy projects which may or may not increase the overall emissions that are taking place in another country, because they presume that somehow, that these governments wouldn't have done the I mean, it's just like smoke and mirrors, the whole thing. I won't go into detail because we'll all get really confused by this, but believe me, it's a scam.
Okay, then we have red. Mm-hmm. Red was always like, oh, finally they're doing something, they're giving some worth to rainforests, mm-hmm. to natural forests, mm-hmm. and now we have Bolivia opposing it, social movements opposing it, indigenous mm. people who are living there opposing mm. it very harshly. So, what is the scandal with RED?
Well, first of all, everyone agrees that we have to protect and preserve forests. We have to find ways to actually regenerate forests that have been destroyed by clear-cut logging. We have to move away from the current model of over-logging and forest consuming the forests, or cutting down the forests and planting soy or whatever it is. So there is a real problem with the way our global forests are being exploited. So we do have to address the problem of forests. But what happens in the RED proposal, or at least one version of the RED proposal, is in fact a forest would not be seen as a place where people live with a diversity of resources inside it, as a place which is an ecosystem of great biodiversity, would have no spiritual or cultural or traditional value. It would simply be, you know, millions of units of carbon, which could then actually be sold on the carbon market for these companies that don't want to reduce their pollutions. So it's a kind of carbon fundamentalism. Some people call it carbon economics or carbon economic. I can't say it, but it's a whole new economic paradigm, if you like, that is based on counting carbon. And so the real fear is not only that the rights of indigenous peoples and biodiversity and forest community, people, communities living in forests, all of their rights will be completely obliterated, but that the forest will be seen purely as something to be chopped up into tiny small carbon pieces and sold on the global financial markets. And what RED does not do, as far as we can see, is really address the drivers of deforestation. It does nothing to control the behaviour of the transnational logging companies. It does absolutely nothing to limit the expansion of soy production or other agrofuels into forested areas. It does nothing to stop the expansion of industrial agriculture. It does absolutely nothing to limit the demand for forest products from the rich countries, you know. So I think that we can think of much more efficient ways to protect and preserve forests, which actually engage communities and give real validity to the contribution and the culture and the communities who are living into the forests, and without economising the whole thing. I think that's, as I said at the beginning, that's what we see time after time in every aspect of these negotiations. It's nothing to do with ecology, it's everything to do with economics.
Last question. In Copenhagen, we've seen quite a criminalization of social movements, of protest movements. Here in Cancun, we have accusations that the civil society and groups are really silenced. Protest is silenced, people can't even get here, all this. What is the role of the UNFCCC in this aspect? Is the process, this process of negotiations, excluding social movements, does it have, this is a hard word, legitimacy?
Mm-hmm.
And is a failure of this conference probably better than a compromise with a very bad, poor result?
Well, I'll answer the last question first. I think absolutely it's much better to have a failure. It's much better to have no agreement here, because what's been negotiated and the way in which everything is moving is completely catastrophic in terms of really dealing with the causes of climate change and the causes of the ecological and social crises that we see everywhere. And, you know, I would just like to repeat that I don't think we can see climate change in isolation from the broader system, that we are living in a time of a very deep social and ecological crises across the world. And we can see that climate is a real flashpoint, because our energy systems, the way we organise our economies, the whole way we organise our societies is bound up in this question of climate change. So that's, of course, why everyone is interested, because there are incredible vested interests at play here, because power relations that have been deeply entrenched in the fossil economy are definitely threatened by any real transformation which would actually take us along a different path of organising the relationship between economy and ecology. And so I think that's why the UN and the powerful groups who are really managing this process are so paranoid about having any kind of real debate about the issues, because they know it's all a pack of cards, right? I mean, the whole thing is built on false assumptions. It's built on economic modelling, which is based on completely arbitrary notions of you know, the price of carbon. I mean, the whole thing is a pure chimera, the way it's been constructed. And I think that the fact is, social movements, the farmers' organisations, indigenous peoples, fishers, people who've been kicked off their land because of, you know, soy plantations, they know what's going on. I mean, they live with the reality of how the brutality of this economic system. And I think that somehow that confrontation with the truth is too much. And I think that at some kind of, you know, at so many different levels, it's not wanting to confront the truth there's also, I really believe, a kind of aesthetic resistance, you know, to seeing the real people. Because if you're confronted with the visual consequences of your incredibly destructive economic policies, it challenges you, right, even as a person. Also, this whole system, the whole process is so chaotic, so fragmented, so contentious, that I'm sure, you know, the UNFCCC as a kind of good bureaucracy wants to make the thing as efficient as possible. And so they don't want to have all of this disruption. They don't want to have too many people in the rooms. They don't want to have, you know, more problems that they can deal with. So I imagine from their perspective, you know, that the smooth running of the conference is at one level a kind of priority. But of course, the smooth running means that you actually sanitize the whole thing. Because the smooth running means that it's absolutely, it's bland, it's got no body, it's got no life in it. It's just nothing. It's a bland process. So I think that there are lots of different reasons why they've excluded groups. I think that last year, what we saw in Copenhagen was a tremendously chaotic situation that really angered even a lot of government delegates, because they were standing for a very long time in the queues in the very, very cold weather, and there was extremely high levels of frustration. So I also think that the UN Secretariat is responding to those frustrations from the delegates. But let's just, in finishing, I'd like to point out that it's not only civil society that's been excluded. There are something like 26 countries that do not have one single representative here. There are 30 countries that have only two representatives. Okay, if you add those together, it's more than one quarter of the countries who are meant to be involved. So a quarter of the countries in the world are represented by, what, 60 people? It's a complete lunacy. And when you've been here for the past couple of weeks, you've seen there are little sub-meetings happening all over the place. The distances between the venues are terrific. The cost of staying in a hotel, which is actually close to the venue, is absolutely prohibitive for any delegation from a developing country. So I think that if you could ever find this sort of perfect Kafkaesque moment where form and content come together as a reflection of each other, I think we've found it here in Cancun. The absurdity of the process and the absurdity of the content are perfect mirrors of each other.